Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. One of the defining aspects of our region is the natural beauty. Beaches, crashing surf, tranquil ponds, woodlands, and all the various plants and animals in those habitats. Today we're discussing the natural forces that created the Cape and Islands, the influence of humans on this environment, and how climate change will further alter the Cape and Islands as we know it. We hope you join the conversation. What are some of your favorite natural places on the Cape and Islands? 866-999-4626. You can also send us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Joining us on the phone from his home in Connecticut is Patrick J. Lynch. He's an award-winning illustrator, photographer, and artist, and the author or co-author of 8 books. His most recent is A Field Guide to Cape Cod, including Nantucket, Martha's Vineyard, Block Island, and Eastern Long Island. Welcome, Patrick.
Thank you.
And with us
good to be here.
Yeah, in studio with us is Susan Bellencampi. She's director of Mass Audubon's Felix Nex Wildlife Sanctuary, author of a couple books herself. Her most recent is The Nature of Martha's Vineyard. Welcome back. Good to see you, Susan.
Thank you.
All right, Pat, you live in Connecticut, but you have a long connection to the Cape. When did you start coming to the Cape, and what drew you here?
I'm a birder and whale watcher, so starting in the probably late 70s or so, I started coming out to the Cape pretty regularly to do bird watching. And when whale watching started up and the early dolphin fleet started going out, the birders jumped right on that. So I've been coming to the Cape now for, 40 plus years.
And what got you started writing field guides?
Well, I've always been interested in natural history, and I spent a lot of my career at Yale as a medical and biological illustrator. So I was in that sort of milieu, and friends and I got together and did various kinds of books. I've done ornithology books and field guides on mostly coastal areas up and down the Atlantic East Coast. And 4 books on web design, which was a whole nother dimension.
And Susan, your work at Felix Nex has you immersed in nature every day. What do you find unique and special about this region? Because you've written, this is your second book, and not you weren't expecting to write a book either, right?
I actually was not expecting to write the first or the second book, but I actually credit the first book with bringing me to the vineyard. I had a connection through family who had a house on the vineyard, but had kind of been involved in my career and was living in Jersey when I actually got I saw a job advertised in the newspaper, and I went to the island to interview for the job, and I read a book by Anne Hale called Moraine to Marsh, and I figured I'd get the language, get the lingo. I aced the interview, and it was Moraine to Marsh, which I rewrote as my first book.
Pat, as the subtitle of your book suggests, the Cape and Islands connected to Long Island and Block Island. I think many residents don't think of themselves as part of New York, but we're all the product of the same geological process, right? So explain.
Sure. So my book is about the sandy, glacially derived, ocean-facing coasts of southeastern New England. And if you look at the environments, the beaches, salt marshes, maritime forest, et cetera, there's a huge number of commonalities all the way from really Brooklyn and Breezy Point in Queens all the way around in a 250-mile arc to Race Point. There's huge commonalities in the environments there, lots of consistency. And so I wanted to address them in a sort of holistic way and look at the commonalities there.
And this environment is often called the Outer Lands. So what are the specific features of the Outer Lands, and how do they compare to other areas of New England's coast?
Well, when you think of New England's coast generically, you tend to think of rocks. But the Outer Lands are characterized by the fact that there is no exposed bedrock anywhere through that arc of the ocean-facing coasts of Long Island, Block Island, Martha's Vineyard, Nantucket, Cape Cod. The bedrock is 200 feet plus below the surface and more. So the landforms were all formed, at least on their surface, by the latest glaciation, which peaked about 25,000 years ago, what people sort of generically call the Ice Age. And so all of our landforms in that region were formed that way. There's no rock. It's all soft earth. And, of course, there are boulders in the rocks, but there's no bedrock exposed. So it erodes, for example. It's a very soft coast. And so that is an issue these days with sea level rise.
Yeah, sure is. Susan, what are some of the most prominent features of the glacier's advance and retreat on the vineyard?
The vineyard is truly a product of the glacial action. If you are up island, which is Chilmark, Aquinnah, and West Tisbury, you'll see stone walls and glacial erratics, which were those large rocks that were left by the glaciers. Up island also is hillier. And the soils are more full of clay, which basically defines the plants that are going to live there. So when you begin to understand the geology, you understand the plant life, and what comes after is the wildlife. So geology defines what you're seeing. Yeah. Frost bottoms are another really unique feature of the vineyard.
Tell us what frost bottoms are.
So frost bottoms are kind of long, narrow channels that go north-south on the vineyard. And the easiest way to describe the experiencing them for those who have been on the island is you go down the Egertown-West Tisbury Road, and it's up and down, and you go down into this hollow, and it's very cold. Now, these were formed from meltwater, from the glacier. Spring sapping of water melting, and they're basically these long channels that lead into our great ponds on the south shore.
The southeastern Massachusetts landmass extends under the sea with a long sloping continental shelf and then a steep drop off into deep water. We don't often think of the underwater topography, but if we go back tens of thousands of years ago, sea level was approximately 350 feet lower than today, and the continental shelf was a landmass. Pat, how different was the climate of our region back then, and do we know what plant and animal species were here?
Well, we know a bit about them because we can study, for example, pollen in ancient lake beds and other things that would give us a pretty good profile, at least of the pollen-producing, wind-producing plants in the area. So we know that the climate, say, at the peak of glaciation about 25,000 years ago was more like what you'd see in Labrador today. And it's a little bit difficult to sort of imagine if you're not familiar with the geology, because the Cape Cod region at that point was as much as several hundred miles inland, because, as you say, the sea level was dramatically lower. It was 350 to 400 feet lower because so much of the Earth's water was bound up in this giant ice sheet. So people often wonder, well, where did everything come back from? Everything was buried under ice 25,000 years ago, and then the ice melted. How did things come back? Well, the things didn't have to come from North Carolina or whatever. What's now the continental shelf was full of taiga and tundra forests and what we would consider northern forests, probably even the most moderate areas would be more like northern Maine, spruce forests and things. So as soon as the glaciers started retreating, the stuff that was living on what's now the continental shelf began to repopulate the bare rock and mud that the glaciers left behind. And gradually the sea level rose as the ice sheet melted back to the Arctic.
And, of course, that long sloping continental shelf contributing to the uniqueness not only of the region but the vineyard as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the thing you're describing. So visitors to the Cape and the islands get confused when they hear terms Upper Cape or Down Cape, because Down Cape is north of the Upper Cape. And then we have, you mentioned Up Island, Susan, versus Down Island. So first, Susan, let's start with you. The origin of the vineyard descriptions.
We have our own language on the vineyard. Anyone who comes and hears the word Pinkeltink is going to realize that. Up Island tends to be, you know, it really came from latitude. So Up Island tends to be on the left side, which I said was West Tisbury, Chilmark, and Aquinnah. And Down Island is on the east or the right side of the island, which would be Vineyard Haven, Egertown, and Oak Bluffs.
All right. You mentioned Pinkeltinks. So I have to say, I actually have it marked in the books because I thought that was, it's everybody's favorite, the peepers. Spring is here, the peepers, and you call them Pinkeltinks.
We call them Pinkeltinks, Hyla crucifer, actually now Pseudocris crucifer. But the Pinkeltinks actually should be arriving in about a month or so, but they are small tree frogs that fill the spring with their sound, their calls, their mating calls, and that should happen soon. But right now, what's interesting about them is they're kind of being little frog popsicles.
Yeah.
These animals still exist even though it's winter, and they actually can freeze without harming themselves due to kind of some cellular magic that they do.
All right. Also, we have to mention this term Pinkeltink. There's a men's digital magazine, Lifestyle Magazine, that says
Thrillist.
Yeah, that says drop this anytime you can. What makes you sound cool? What is that?
Exactly. Well, it was one of my kind of favorite quotes. It was Thrillist, which bills itself as a top style magazine for men. And it was suggesting that millennials take every opportunity to drop the word Pinkeltink.
All right, Pat, what about the terms Upper Cape, Down Cape? But explain the origin of those terms.
Oh, well, up and down referred to the prevailing winds in the warmer times of year. So you went upwind against the winds coming from the southwest. And so if you were heading to, the Upper Cape area, you'd be going upwind, and downwind would be toward Provincetown and the end of the Cape. So it got to be the Down Cape or Lower Cape. In my experience, not being a native Cape Codder, I get blank stares when I talk about Down Cape and whatnot. So when I was writing the book, I was casting around for something that sounded more logical, and I noticed that the real estate industry uses Upper Cape, Mid Cape, Lower Cape being the kind of Chatham elbow mm-hmm. area, and then Outer Cape for yep. the rest of it, say north of there, Eastham, Wellfleet, Truro, Town, etc. And that sounded more logical to me. So I actually put a little map in the book that explains the different terminologies, including Lower Cape, but said that I'm going to say Outer Cape because it makes more sense to me.
People understand. And you have great illustrations in the book. I'm looking at page 20 that shows how the different ice slopes covered the region. And it's fascinating to see how the ice formed the last landmass shapes that we're so familiar with. So would you describe the Cape Cod Bay Lobe and the Buzzard Bay Lobes and how they gave shape to the landmasses of the Cape and Islands?
So what geologists call the Laurentide Ice Sheet was essentially one gigantic glacier. You could think of it as a gigantic extension of the North Pole coming down all the way into the Cape and Islands region, and Long Island is where it stopped coming down. That is, the rate of melting because of the Gulf Stream and other things matched the rate at which the glacier was flowing southward, and that's where it stopped in the so-called terminal moraine across Long Island and formed Block Island, Martha's Vineyard, and Nantucket. But within that gigantic ice sheet, there were separate identifiable flows. So there's a Buzzards Bay Lobe, a Cape Cod Bay Lobe, and the South Channel Lobe. And South Channel Lobe was gigantic. It was much larger than all the others. And people know the Great South Channel, which is east of the outer beaches of Cape Cod. And that whole huge valley was filled up with a giant glacial lobe. As those lobes came down, they had a sort of rounded front to them. So there were gaps in between right at the southernmost extension of them. And you could think of glaciers as like they're nothing like the ice cubes in your freezer. They're full of rocks and dust and silt and all kinds of things that they scrape off the surface like a bulldozer. And also because they flow, albeit slowly, they're sort of like a conveyor belt as well. Mm. So at the place where a glacier stops, you get this line of rubble that's dumped out of the melting edge of the glacier. And there were notches, roughly triangular notches, between the Buzzards Bay, Cape Cod Bay, and South Channel lobes, and which gives the sort of roughly triangular shapes to Martha's Vineyard and Nantucket, the upland areas anyway.
Yeah.
And so that's why the lobes were important. Also, the South Channel lobe was gigantic. It was thousands of feet thick and filled Great South Channel all the way north of there. So runoff from that and all the rubble from that is what essentially created the Outer Cape. So it's a little bit tough to sort of describe it verbally, but once you see these big arcs of the individual lobes, you realize that they're still directly reflected in the landscape we can see today.
Yeah, and Susan, is it apparent on the vineyard that the island was formed by two different lobes?
It is once you kind of help people understand it. The bulldozer, the way Patrick described it is a very apt description. So the bulldozer kind of pushed. And if you think about the northeast and northwest side of the island where the terminal moraine was laid down, that's going to be the hilly, the rocky, and then the middle of the island, the state forest, is going to be your outwash plain where there's well-drained soils and kind of the soils that got moved down. And then finally, what was happening is when the glaciers melted, they actually had kind of kept melting into the ocean. The last part of the formation of the vineyard specifically was the post-glacial deposits, basically the ocean putting sand back on and closing up the bottom of the island. And that's some of the most dynamic parts of the island still.
Yeah. We're discussing the natural forces that created the Cape and Islands and the influence of humans on the environment and how climate change will further alter the Cape and Islands as we know it. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. And we'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point, and we are discussing the natural forces that created the Cape and Islands. We're going to get into the influence humans have on the environment and how climate change could further alter the Cape and Islands as we know it. What are some of your favorite natural places on the Cape and Islands, and what changes have you seen in the landscape, beaches, and environment over time? 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. In studio with us is Susan Bellencampi, Director of Mass Audubon's Felix Neck Wildlife Sanctuary. Her new book is The Nature of Martha's Vineyard. Patrick J. Lynch is an award-winning illustrator, photographer, and artist, and his latest book is A Field Guide to Cape Cod, including Nantucket, Martha's Vineyard, Block Island, and Eastern Long Island. All right, so we talk about the retreat of the ice, but it didn't just march back, it melted. So, Pat, describe what movement of the melted water created some of the common features in our landscape, like, the kettle ponds and holes, the outwash valleys, that sort of thing.
Sure. Well, 25,000 years ago, the Earth's climate began to warm, and the big ice sheet started to melt back, but it did not melt back in an even way. There were periods, sometimes as long as 1,000 years, where for a variety of reasons, the Earth's climate stopped warming and the glaciers stopped melting, and in a couple of cases, even began to advance forward again. And that's where that real bulldozer effect comes in, because they had retreated across the landscape and then suddenly started back down south again and sort of crumpled the land almost like the crumpled hood of a car in an accident. So that's where you get, for example, the highlands and the inner Cape, is that kind of crumpled landscape as the glaciers started forward again. So there are two major moraines that go across this whole region from New York City all the way to P-Town. And the terminal moraine created the South Fork of Long Island and Block Island and Martha's Vineyard and Nantucket. But then the ice melted back for a few thousand years. The climate cooled again, and then in many cases, the glacier began to move forward again, or at least stopped, and that kind of conveyor belt effect left a whole another huge line of rubble across the region, and that became the North Fork of Long Island, a significant part of the Rhode Island coast, and then the Elizabeth Islands all the way up into the base of the Cape, which has the highest elevations there. So big piles, big, huge, hundreds of miles long piles of rubble across the landscape. And it was a landscape. The sea level was still very low at this point, so the sea was still several hundred miles south of all this. And in natural weathering, as Susan was saying, say on Martha's Vineyard, this big, huge pile of rubble that the terminal moraine left began washing all the lighter stuff down. And so most of the south of Martha's Vineyard and Nantucket and a huge part of the middle part of Cape Cod is all what geologists call an outwash plain. So it's a lot flatter. It's somewhat less rocky. But again, this wasn't a nice, neat story of the ice just melting away. All of this took thousands of years to happen. And particularly on the Cape, the ice left behind huge chunks. And by huge, I mean like city block or more sized chunks of ice, essentially icebergs stuck in the outwash plains of the Cape. And those later became the kettle ponds of Cape Cod. Mm. Most of the larger bodies of water, the freshwater bodies on Cape Cod, are all from these gigantic chunks of ice, which in some cases took thousands of years to finally melt away entirely. And so that's why when you fly over the Cape, and especially when the sun hits it a certain way, Cape Cod looks like Swiss cheese. There's so many of these lakes in there, and they were all from these giant chunks of ice that were kind of left over as the glacier retreated.
Yeah, it's a good way to describe it, like Swiss cheese. So we know the wind and sea changes the shape of our coastline, but how and where sediment moves varies greatly from place to place. And Pat, in your book, you have an illustration that shows the shores that experience erosion only and those that experience both sand erosion and deposits. So along what Cape shorelines do we see erosion only, and why is that?
Well, particularly in the outer Cape, there's a lot of erosion because the outer Cape is very exposed to ocean waves and things. So, for example, so the ocean rose as the glaciers melted away. And about 5,000-6,000 years ago, Cape Cod, as we would roughly recognize it today, began to take shape, except that it was a much larger Cape Cod, much wider, thicker. And it's been eroding away. In fact, the outer Cape, say around the Truro Wellfleet area, was probably 3 or 4 miles wider toward the ocean than it is today, because right now, at the rate it melts back or erodes back, it's probably 3 to 5 feet horizontal feet a year, and so a lot of the Cape has been essentially melting away there, but it doesn't go away entirely. The, for example, the from about downtown Truro north, there is what oceanographers call a node, that is where things are swept either north or south along the coast from that point. So sweeping north, all of that erosion of the old, much wider outer Cape is what created the province lands and P-Town and all that sand. All that sand went north, and the tip of northern tip of Cape Cod is essentially a giant sand spit. Mm. So so that's one direction. And then the other direction, the erosion travels down south, and it creates, you know, the sort of Coast Guard Beach area, those long peninsulas that run along Nauset and that area, and then all the way down to Monomoy. It's all essentially sand that's been eroding off the main body of the Cape and collecting. So when the ocean waves tear up Cape Cod, and especially those outer cliffs, most of the sand ends up in the ocean. But some of it, because of what's called a longshore current that travels parallel to the coast, is brought down to, you know, say the Coast Guard Beach area, Nauset, Monomoy, et cetera. And you see similar effects all over the Cape. For example, Sandy Neck is the result of longshore currents and some of that eroded sand being redeposited back. And as Susan was saying, an awful lot of the features you see, particularly in the southern parts of the Martha's Vineyard in Nantucket, are pure sand, either eroded off those highlands from the glacial moraines, or In the case of, say, Nantucket, I suspect an awful lot of the northern sort of spike you see that sort of points toward Monomoy is probably sand that came off the Cape and is part of that ocean system.
Yeah. Susan, aside from the Aquiniclifs, which we're going to talk about in a minute, what vineyard shores are most subject to ongoing erosion?
One of the kind of prime examples is over on Chappaquiddick on Waysquay, where a house had to be moved back. A lot of that erosion has to do with storms and the breaking of the barrier beaches. The shell shore erodes. Pretty much all of the coasts are eroding in different ways. Aquina is another example. But a lot of the increase, and we're going to talk about that with climate change, is having to do with these heavy storms that are really pounding at the shores.
Yeah. Pat, you mentioned the Province Land Dunes and Sandy Neck and Barnstable results of accumulating sand, but it appears that sea level might be happening faster than that the sand deposits are happening. So I'm thinking of the parking lot at Herring Cove Beach in Provincetown. That's a region where sand is typically deposited, yet the beach parking lot has had to be moved several times. And so talk a little about this accelerated rate of sea level rise and how that's impacting the shoreline.
So it's good to know geology because it gives you some perspective and some history about what's likely to happen with sea level rise, because the sea's gone up and down lots of times. I mean, within the context of a human lifetime, you look at a map and the shores seem to be where they always were. But in fact, for example, when the Pilgrims landed, sea level was, at least 2 feet lower than it is today. So the sea's been gradually rising since the end of the peak glaciation 25,000 years ago. The big concern now, because of global warming and climate change, is that the rate at which the sea level has risen has taken a sharp turn upward. People describe it as a sort of hockey stick. There was a gradual sloping upward curve, and then suddenly there's this bump up because of a number of different factors. A lot of the ice around the world, either in the polar ice caps or in glaciers, is melting and contributing to some of that. Also, there's the physical effect of warm water occupying slightly more space than cold water does. So at the scale of an ocean, that can result in significant noticeable sea level rise. So for a variety of reasons, the water's coming up. And in an area like Cape Cod that has all soft shores, soft earthen shores, that can cause a lot of damage. What's happening, say, in the Herring Cove area is probably most immediately bad luck, in that we've had some bad nor'easters lately. And it used to be when you described specific weather events like what tore up the Herring Cove parking lot and whatnot, you had to sort of ritually bow to the fact that weather isn't climate. There's a difference. Mm-hmm. You can't ascribe everything to climate change. But now, particularly over the last 5 years, climate scientists have harder and harder data that we're not imagining things. Storms are getting worse. Mm-hmm. Hurricanes feed off the hot ocean water in the tropics, and they're getting worse. Severe hurricanes are getting worse. Not hugely. It's no point in running and hiding or building bomb shelters, but nevertheless, there is a change in things. And so I think gradually climate scientists, even the most conservative ones, are becoming more comfortable with saying, yeah, every time Marconi Beach loses its stairway, that probably is at least a weak signal of climate change and not just there've always been bad storms on the Outer Cape. Mm. Same thing with the Herring Cove parking lot, which I remember personally at least three versions of before whatever they do lately. It's making me feel like an old man because I remember a very different Coast Guard beach, very different Marconi. You know, every time I go to Marconi Beach, it's brand new stairs. They look beautiful, but it must cost them a fortune.
Yeah, I know. And I think we all can see, I'm just thinking in my own experience, Surf Drive here in Falmouth, where the road is pretty close to to the beach there, but I moved here in 1997, and I remember it being a little bit farther to the water. That beach is definitely eroded somewhat, and you know, my husband who grew up here, he remembers that beach being much bigger when he was a kid, and yeah, it seems like that doesn't seem like a very long time span for that kind of change. And I think lots of people have seen in their own areas this you know, the loss of some beaches here and there. Yeah.
There's lots of concrete examples of it. I've been giving talks around my home region of Connecticut now about sea level rise and stuff. And you can go to the average beach and you look at Long Island Sound in my case, and everything seems pretty much the same as it was. But if you've been involved in natural history for a while, you realize that there are specific places where it just, you know, calls out to you, places that have eroded back. We love to watch seals in the wintertime around here, and there are a couple of places like at Hammonasset State Park along the Long Island Sound coast where the seals are practically at your feet now.
Oh, wow.
And a lot of us who were birding and watching seals and whatnot since back in the 70s and 80s remember that it used to be twice as far or more. So it happens gradually, but it's happening constantly, and it's especially dramatic on the Cape and Islands, again, because of the geology and all that soft earth that gets eroded away.
And while we like to talk about all the natural changes, I think what's really been interesting that I've seen in the last 5 years is the towns, the roads, the structures are now being affected. And that's where communities are beginning to look at it a little differently. Like, yes, the beaches are smaller, but now we're having to rebuild our roads. Mm-hmm. Beach Road between Oak Bluffs and Edgartown now gets closed due to storms and overwash. And so it's just in the last few years where it's really getting the attention of folks who are doing emergency management, and that our human-made structures are also in jeopardy.
Yeah, and it costs money. You come to a point, you go, okay, when do we stop fixing that particular road? And that's a really tough call, you know. And people with, you know, we didn't always have houses built so close to the shoreline. I mean, if you look at the sea captains, their houses were down a main street. They weren't on the beach, because
right.
They knew, you know, the fury of Mother Nature, if you will. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point, and we are discussing the natural forces that created the Cape and Islands, the influence of humans on the environment, and how climate change could further alter the Cape and Islands as we know it. 866-999-4626 is our number, our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. In studio with me is Susan Bellencampi, director of Mass Audubon's Felix Neck Wildlife Sanctuary and author of The Nature of Martha's Vineyard. Patrick J. Lintz is the author of A Field Guide to Cape Cod, including Nantucket, Martha's Vineyard, Block Island, and Eastern Long Island. And Meg is giving us a call from Harwich. Hi, Meg.
Hi. There's a beach in Truro called Long Nook. It is a spectacular beach, but it has a huge drop-off. Mm-hmm. They usually, depending on how it is, there's usually a rope, so you could hold the rope to get down to the beach, a large drop-off. But it's a jewel that most people don't ever go to. And that is a terrific beach.
Yeah.
Nice walking place. And just a quick one. When my daughter's pen pals from Singapore came over, they wanted to go to a beach on the Cape, and I wanted to take them to a place that was a little different. I took them there, and they also wanted to have their picture taken with, they were, at that time, they were like 20. They wanted to have their picture taken with some men from the Cape. So there were 10 men that would let the girls have their picture. It was a delight for everybody. They all loved it.
All right, Meg, I was going to say, Meg, you know, you're giving away secrets, which we love, but, you know, everybody who goes to that beach now is going, Meg, stop telling people about this.
Well, that's why it's a jewel. It's going to be hard to find, but on the way back yesterday, National Seashore has some great new films. One is on sharks. It's a very short one. And the other one is sort of an updated Sands of Time. everybody would be delighted, and all you have to do is ask the people at the front desk, and they'll put on the film you want.
Oh, great.
That's all. Have a nice day.
All right, thanks, Meg. Appreciate that. Yeah, if you have a spot that you'd like to share with a favorite natural place, we'd love to hear it. 866-999-4626. I know I get really upset when, you know, some national magazine highlights some little secret, and you go, no, and then there's buses of people.
That's the intersection, you know, how people love these spaces, and they're changing dramatically.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where people really connect and understand, begin to understand what's going on.
What's going on, yeah. Janie is giving us a call from Nantucket. Good morning, Janie.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
So this is just so timely, and I'm kind of tuning in late, so I might have missed some, like, important information. But we're actually having a meeting today about coastal resiliency. And so I've been doing a little, you know, in especially the west end of the island, Nantucket has tremendous amounts of erosion, you know, like 1 foot to 9 feet. I'm sort of making that up, but it's pretty close to that per year. So I've been like doing some research online and stuff like that. And I'm trying to figure out what can citizens do. From our point of view, what can, like, community members, like village people who live in the village of Nantucket, what are the things? Is there anything that they can do?
That's a great question. Let's find it. Susan, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, one of the things that we tend to do is we tend to build and then we rebuild. And I think that's we've got to start thinking about where is it appropriate to actually build. Should we be building right on the edge? You know, should we be rebuilding when some of the storms or things are we're getting lost. Also, the towns have taken on this MVP process, municipal vulnerability preparedness, and we're starting to talk about, you know, what do we do, for example, on the Vineyard when the Chappie Ferry is now flooded and people can't get over. And so I think what you can do is start to plan, start to think, and start to make plans with your community on what are your options.
Yeah. And I think, you know, zoning doesn't sound very sexy, but the zoning, that's where the action happens. Pat, what are your thoughts?
I was sort of cringing in the previous caller calling out my favorite beaches on Cape Cod or those North Truro ones. But my first thought about that was, that there's a terrific example of why you need to be really careful about those building anywhere near the coast. In North Truro, there's a beach called Coast Guard Beach. Mm-hmm. It's Truro's Coast Guard Beach. And a couple of years ago, a gigantic, like, 2-acre part of the cliffs there, which are probably almost 100 feet high, collapsed suddenly, you know, in a few seconds. Right. And that's really the danger of these cliff areas. We can say, well, on average, they erode 3 to 5 feet a year, but that's misleading, as what tends to happen is in the winter when the storms are much more violent, when the waves are much more violent, and there's a whole lot more rain, these clay cliffs get saturated with water. And every once in a while, instead of, you know, just inch by inch, even corrosion during the course of the year, whole sections of cliff just disappear. Mm-hmm. And it's very humbling to stand there on the beach and think,
see that,
you know,
yeah.
Wow, I'm glad I wasn't here when that happened.
Yeah.
But it gives you some idea why, as you said, the old timers did not build on the edge of things.
Yeah.
There's a deep sort of wisdom there. They didn't have the emergency services and the weather services and other kinds of things. They were a lot more conservative about where they built. And I think we've got to go back to that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Is sure, you get great views for a few years if you put your house right on the edge. But as lots of places, there are various stories floating around now from Chatham all the way up to Wellfleet and whatnot about expensive houses that are about to pitch into the ocean.
Right. And we've had it happen. So since you mentioned cliff erosion, talk a little bit about Aquinnah and what's happening there.
So Aquinnah
is a beautiful spot. Yeah.
Aquinnah is the cliffs of Gay Head are incredibly beautiful. There were, you know, to go back to the geology formed through the action of a thrush fault, kind of crumpling like ribbon candy. And then what's happening is now it's eroding. The Gayhead Lighthouse was getting precipitously close to the edge and was recently moved back, back from the edge. And I think that's, similar to some of the Nantucket. I think there's on Nantucket another lighthouse that has been moved. And the Cape Pogue Lighthouse has also been moved, where it's a continuous overtime thing. And so moving back of the lighthouse, you know, was something that had to be done in order to save the historic structure. And it was a community effort where the town got together and raised the money and really just deciding it was an important piece. The other thing about the what you can do is really having conservation land and uplands so that as sea level, you know, increases, you have somewhere to go. So instead of, you know, a lawn or pavement, you really want natural spaces like marshes and things that can absorb storm energy and that is going to protect what's behind it.
Yeah. How much of Martha, I don't know if you know the answer to this, how much of Martha's Vineyard is conservation or protected?
I actually do. It's 40%.
Oh, which is Nantucket is a little bit more than that. Yeah.
Nantucket's a little bit more.
Yeah, that's
and
good.
And communities have done a really good job, and conservation land does put land in makes it safe for some of these new coming threats.
Right. Let's talk to Jay, who's giving us a call from Chilmark. Hi, Jay.
Yes.
Yeah. Go.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yep, we can hear you. Go ahead.
Yes, I live a half mile in from the Wequabsqui Cliffs, which I believe in Wampanoag that means high cliffs, and they're actually higher than the Gayhead Cliffs. But they're not as colorful or anything. But I've been watching this since 1950. Of course, I don't remember then. I was six. But the cliffs have gotten very steep in the last, 20 years because they're being eaten out so much faster than they used to be. And like you were saying, big chunks, sometimes, 50 feet deep at a time, a big hunk, will go down in a slump. And sometimes it even picks up the beach. It slides under the beach, and the beach comes up. Like I remember once about 5 years ago or 10 years ago, it was like 10 or 12 feet above the beach level.
An interesting thing about those cliffs is that you want to believe that they're eroding from the water, but they're actually slumping off from saturation and from the sapping of water going over them. Mm. So it's water actually coming from the other way, not only from the ocean. And so typically after large, drenching rains, they'll just fall.
Yeah. And Pat, you devote a chapter of your book to the impacts of humans on the land. And so what do you consider the biggest human impacts on the Cape and Islands environments through the early 20th century?
Well, there isn't a square inch of the Cape and Islands that hasn't been heavily influenced and modified by man. And I knew a fair amount about the natural history of the Cape from birding and whale watching and general interest in natural history. But when I was working on the book, I was really struck in doing a lot more reading about history that the Cape has been at various times, a verdant sort of garden in pre certainly European history to by the middle 1800s, a sandy wasteland. Of ruined and abandoned farms and clear-cut forests, et cetera. And now it has come back again in a particularly vibrant way. It's gorgeous, of course. Mm. But I think about that when I, say, standing in the province lands and the sort of quintessentially Cape Cod environment of pine trees and ocean and, lots and lots of interesting birds and plants and things. And you sort of have to have this weird dichotomy in your head. On the one hand, it's a gorgeous natural environment. On the other hand, it's entirely artificial. The province lands are in the relatively early stages of a recovery from being overgrazed and clear-cut all the way up into the late 1800s. So it's interesting when you look at the human history of the Cape to realize it's a perfect lesson of what geologists and environmentalists are now calling the Anthropocene Age. That is the geologic age when humans have by far the biggest impact on the landscape. Mm-hmm. And Cape Cod's a perfect microcosm of that. All these beautiful environments that we look at are simultaneously gorgeous. I'm thinking mm-hmm. of like the heaths around Marconi Station, for example. You can just look down and see just mile after mile of these gorgeous rolling sort of dune heaths and things. Those were entirely artificial. They were from ruined farms and clear cuts. But here's the weird thing. You can look at, say, 1619, maybe before the Pilgrims landed and there was lots of European colonization, and say, well, that's a potential benchmark. What was the Cape like then? It was almost entirely forested, heavy forest, almost all the way to the water's edge, the way the Pilgrims described it, later people.
Very different. You know, Rebecca called in from Truro, and she had a question that points to what we were talking about, mm-hmm. the infrastructure. She wonders how the paved road can survive the one that goes out to Lieutenant Island that gets covered over in high tide. And that's true. I guess remains to be seen, right? I mean, I don't know how you keep repairing that. And you have to really time your, you know, leaving your comings
right.
and goings.
Is it high tide? Yeah. Is it low tide? Right. Is the storm coming? And that is a problem that communities are having.
Yeah. Eleanor sent us a note. She says, I'm an artist lucky enough to have one of the old camps at Lake Tashmu. It's still quiet and spectacular in the winter, truly a bird haven, but motorboats, light, noise, and pollution arrive with summer. The lake was originally freshwater before a channel was opened to the sound. The water moves closer and closer as the shoreline remarkably changes since we bought the place in 1985. Inexplicably, small old camps and barns are fast mm-hmm. being converted into large houses. Is there a limit? And you know, that's a good. That is a lovely. I love that Tashmu area. And I'm sorry, you know, Eleanor, kind of wish we aren't mentioning it because I don't want other people to know about it either. Yeah. So we only have a couple of minutes left here, and we didn't get to a lot of the things I wanted to talk about. But I guess one of the things, and Pat, real quickly, some of the species and animals that are experiencing the impacts of this warming climate, thoughts on that?
The climate's changing a lot. And one thing to remember about this is that wild environments do change and react, and over time, it's not all a sad story. There are lots of birds that we used to have that we don't have anymore when things are colder, but those have been, biological productivity tends to stay the same, albeit with different characters. When you're managing an environment, say the way the National Seashore has to, you got to take all of those things into account.
Yeah.
The Cape used to be almost 100% forest. It's actually much more a diverse environment now, with a much more diverse cast of animal and plant characters.
And I'm going to have to stop you there, Patrick. We're having some kind of weird sort of background noise with you. I don't know if happened with the phone connection there. So for the last minute, Susan, one of the things we didn't get to a lot of the stuff in the book, you talk about a lot about the animals, fauna, you know, flora, all of that in your book, and some really interesting things there. So just kind of your final thoughts as well.
Sure. I mean, when you're talking about what the wildlife you see results from the glaciers, it results from the habitat. And climate change, although you don't want to focus on the negative, you do want to be aware of what's happening. You know, an example that I use are snapping turtles. When their nest is cooler, you have females. It gets warmer, you get males, and it gets warmer again, and you have females. And so when the temperatures is increasing, it is going to affect the wildlife populations. However, the end answer is that we are really blessed and gifted with all of the beauty that we have on the island. Mm. And respecting that and learning about it and protecting it is really the best thing we can do.
And I would say the island, this whole region, we're very lucky. And if you haven't gotten out and explored beyond your own little town, highly encourage you to do so. Each town on the Cape, as well as the islands, have their own personality and own beauty. So get out and explore that. Patrick J. Lynch, author of A Field Guide to Cape Cod, including Nantucket, Martha's Vineyard, Block Island, and Eastern Long Island. Thank you. Susan Bellencampi, director of Mass Audubon's Felix Neck Wildlife Sanctuary and author of The Nature of Martha's Martha's Vineyard. Thanks for coming in, Susan. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.